Hello, friends, and welcome to Coach Cut's Corner. Streaming bright from Michigan's capital city, this podcast is dedicated to helping you better understand the who, the what, and the why of mental performance, personal growth, and Lansing Stars baseball. Coach Cut's Corner, brought to you by Eyewash.
In collaboration with Lansing Community College.
And now here's your host, Stephen Cutter.
Welcome to Coach Cut's Corner, where we challenge limits, push for greatness, and develop athletes who thrive on and off the field. Today, I'm sitting down with someone who embodies all of that, Ryan Raddick. Ryan was a standout outfielder for the Stars, well on his way to the Division I level, until a knee injury last season forced him into a season-ending surgery. Instead of walking away, Ryan chose to give back, trading in his role as a player for a new one as a coach. This is Ryan's second time on the show. He was a guest on episode 30, The Long Road Back. And as we near 100 episodes, today we're going to talk about his journey, what it's been like to transition from the field to the dugout, and the changes he sees in this year's program. His story is about resilience, perspective, and finding new ways to lead when the path you planned takes a turn. Let's get after it. Welcome back to the WLNZ studios.
Hello, Coach Cutter. Glad to be back.
I'm happy to have you here. Ryan, let's start with your time as a player. You were here for a few seasons, and when you look back in your career here, what stands out the most to you?
Definitely the culture, environment of the program, the constant striving to just be better on and off the field, and the camaraderie of the team just gets built through all that culture that we're taught.
What's it mean to, culture's a buzzword in sports, and it has been for a while. And really, if you break it down, it's environment. What's the environment like? What's the temperature of the environment that you're in?
Yeah.
But what did it mean to wear the Stars jersey and represent the program?
Oh, it's more than just a jersey. It's you're representing the city of Lansing. You're always giving back. Yeah. It's not just how you play on the field. It's how you act on and off the field. Wearing the Stars jersey is just a representation of just being uncommon, selfless, and excellent. Those are our core values, and being the best person you can be every day.
And I think in a lot of ways those are standards, and that's, as a coach, that's exactly what you want to have in your program is standards. But there's also another side to it where the expectations are high for the program. The expectations from the community are high. The expectations from the college are high. The expectations everywhere are high. And we talked about this through the years of whether you're wearing your stuff, your Stars gear or not, a lot of people know who you are. And you've got to be really smart with the things that you're doing. And then the standards are so high that also creates pressure.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes we as people don't do really well with pressure. And so that's been a unique thing in our program is it continues to build and the expectations continue to go up and the pressure continues to rise. And that's why we have to constantly talk about noise and blocking some of the noise out and not paying attention to the noise and staying focused on what's true to you. What are you trying to do? Yes, it's somewhat selfish, but it's, you're here to get better. What do I need to do? And what's most important for me to get better? And sometimes athletes get lost in that. We're in East Lansing. They get lost in all the things that are going on. But I want to kind of move a little bit into the injury and the transition, and I want to talk about that a little bit. Take us back to last season. What happened with the injury, and when did you realize it was as serious as it turned out to be?
Yeah, of course. We were playing a home game at Muni, and I hit a ball to the fence and was going around first base.
So you didn't hit it over?
No, I'm not strong enough.
Okay, fair enough.
Not yet. But, yeah, the guy caught it, and as I was rounding, I picked up my head to kind of look at what was going on, and it was kind of not a dry day. It was kind of wet out. And,
well, it was the spring,
yeah,
so it's typically always wet in Michigan, but yes. Yeah.
And my knee kind of just caved in on me and kind of felt like it exploded on me, and I just collapsed and kind of had the adrenaline pumping during it. So I kind of just popped up and hobbled to the bench and sat down and just held my knee for a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was convinced I was okay.
Okay. So at that point, you thought you were fine. You didn't realize it was serious.
Not at all. It was, I thought, if anything, it was just like a slight like dislocation of the kneecap or something like that. And then the trainer came over and checked it out. Everything seemed fine. So I just took that rest of the day off and then tried to see how it was in the weeks to come. And it was pretty evident that there was something pretty seriously wrong and definitely needed to get it checked out.
You had to go through season-ending surgery. And it took those four-year options off the table for you. How did you process that mentally?
It was pretty tough. I had never really expected my career to end off an injury in terms of college baseball ending. I've had season-ending injuries before,
yeah,
which I'm thankful for having because it gave me the experience. Mm-hmm. And
if you ever want to hear Ryan's full story, go back to episode 30 of
yes.
Coach Cut's Corner, and you can hear all the details of that kind of stuff. But it obviously was a challenging time, right?
Oh, very. Yes. It was definitely challenging to kind of stay motivated and mm-hmm. and want to, like, stay with the team and everything mm-hmm. because I just
it's the most common thing when people yeah. get injured, they just kind of want to get away from it,
yeah,
you know, and trying to keep them around the team is something that I'm constantly trying to do. It doesn't happen as often as I would like. Instead of stepping away from baseball, you chose to move into coaching for the season. What made you decide to go in that direction?
Yeah, so I got the surgery, and I kind of did some soul searching with how I wanted my future to unfold. And
because after the surgery, the recovery was going to be quite extensive, right?
Yes. They said at the very least 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. So more, it was more going to be like 8 or 9 months. So I had some time to kind of just lay out all my cards on the table and kind of see what I really wanted to do with my life. And I didn't think that my career with baseball was over. I still don't. So I thought the best way to stay involved and help others was definitely just to step back into coaching.
Now that you're on the coaching side, what's been the biggest adjustment for you? I think this is questions that should be put on a wall, because people that go from playing to coaching, there are so many incredible stories, you know. So what's been the biggest adjustment for you?
Well, first of all, I'm coaching guys that I played with last year. Mm-hmm. And so some of these guys were my best friends, hung out with them every day. And you kind of have to find those lines, like you've been telling me, mm-hmm. is you can't really be their best friend, but you can be their friend. Another thing is I've always been so critical of my swing and my mechanics. I have one swing in my mind that I need to, you know, develop. But now I've got 20 other guys with different swings that will be developing in different ways. And it's pretty awesome to see how I'm able to kind of talk with them, talk through their mental development with their swing and develop them throughout the season.
What's one lesson that you try to pass on to the guys now?
Oh, yeah. So I definitely would just say that you don't know when it's over. So just give everything you have. And that kind of goes along with one of my favorite sayings, is like, how you do anything is how you do everything.
It's a great saying.
So you just got to give everything you have in every situation, and all the cards will fall in place. And
it's really hard to do.
Yeah, it is.
It's really challenging to do, and that's why a lot of people can't do it. Mm-hmm. It's super challenging. If you were in charge of recruiting, now that you're seeing it from both sides, and you've been with us through the fall on the coaching side, if you were in charge of the recruiting here, what are we looking for in a player?
Definitely character. Okay. I would say work ethic and character are the two biggest things. Just being able to obviously perform. Everyone at this level can perform. Mm-hmm.
Everybody has talent.
Yes, but if you can do the things off the field the right way, whether it's your grades or just being a genuine person off the mm-hmm. field.
The honesty is huge,
yes,
not only huge. With others, but with yourself. You know, that honesty is such an impactful piece. And if you can't be honest with yourself, it's going to be pretty hard to grow.
Oh, yeah.
And if you can't be honest with others, it's going to be pretty hard to develop genuine connections. And to grow, you do need people and you need connections. And it kind of all goes together. And I think, like, how you labeled all that stuff, that's 100% what we're looking for. And some of that stuff is not the normal 60 time and, you know, the bat speed or whatever. Most of the stuff, within reason, you can develop. You've had a front row seat to how this program has grown. From your perspective, what feels different about this year's team compared to last year's team, or maybe even the year before's team?
Definitely the numbers in terms of size or strength don't necessarily pop off the charts, but watching these guys play
compete
as a team has been, like, probably my favorite thing, like, looking forward to this season, because these guys know how to play. They're starting to get very, very closer than any other team at this time that mm-hmm. we've had, that I've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just the camaraderie on and off the field, I'm starting to see is definitely coming together.
What stood out to you about the changes we made to the program this season? You know, there are changes because you saw things as a player, but you're seeing more like almost like a microscope version as a coach. And what stood out about this season, whether it's preparation, culture, mindset, or even the systems that are in play?
Yeah, definitely the use of AI in our hitting programs and pitching programs. That's going to be huge for us. Definitely haven't seen that before, and it seems to be working great.
When you talk about the AI, you're talking about systems and,
yes,
you know, kind of what we've done, and we've talked about it a little bit, but it's not completely out there. But I've taken systems and really energized them. I've had over 10 years of Google Notes of everything you could think of, from motivation to leadership to journaling to hitting philosophies to pitching philosophies. I'm actually reading them on my computer right now, to folders with team talks and folders for mental preparation on failure and all these things. And it's 10 years worth, and it's been really helpful for me. This is where the journaling comes in. Super helpful, because I can go to my search and search grit, and I get anything that I've taken notes on, or any studies from Stanford or anywhere else, and I copy and paste those in there. And and so then we've taken these systems and really just, like, they're on creatine, and they're just really blowing up. And AI is, there about 10 different apps are leveraging all the notes that I have, and we're using Excel and Python and a ton of code and script and all these things. And it's a really cool thing. So when people, you know, slam our program and say they're all about tech, well, I think that's actually a positive thing, because we're using it to leverage growth. Mm-hmm. And it's not perfect, but I can tell you what, it's really individualized. Mm-hmm. And it's really based on what you do, and you don't have to throw 95 where we have chase charts and we have all these different things that have been developed. And it's about whomever you are and getting some results. So I'm glad you kind of got into that. If you were to describe this group right now in one word, what would it be and why?
I would say mature for their age, for sure. They definitely, we have a lot of young guys on the team, but the way they go about the game and the way they handle certain pressure situations that we've had so far has really surprised me, and it's definitely made me more optimistic about our performance in the spring. And I think we've laid a very solid foundation for them just to develop off of that maturity.
Yeah, I think there's a certain level of maturity you need to develop, and without it, it's pretty hard to develop. And of course, that honesty comes into, but it's in reality, it's just trying to get a little bit better and using the systems that are in place, the systems of success, to measure yourself, and you keep measuring. And it's a 6 weeks checks and balances thing. And, you know, we have other things in our program, from readiness to daily readiness tests that are going to talk about your mental state, things that are going to talk about how much sleep you got. And, you know, that's a whole different thing that we're really tracking and leveraging and using. And it's been pretty wild on that side. And a lot of that stuff is really new this season, or at least new this year, because it's getting leveraged in a different way. Mm-hmm. When you look at your journey as a player through the injury, and now as a coach, what's the biggest lesson you've learned?
Definitely just be happy. Just be happy where your feet are. Always be where your feet are. It could always be worse. And we live in we're very privileged to be able to play college baseball, coach college baseball. You could work the rest of your life, but this stuff is going to develop some of the best memories of your life. So
yeah, that's powerful stuff. And the civilian world is a lot different, and sometimes it takes getting into it before you realize, holy smokes, we're so lucky to be able to do what we do. Once you're cleared and fully healthy, which you're getting closer now, I see you swinging a fungo really smoothly, and I know you're hitting and before practice, and I know you're doing stuff and you're running and running distance and stuff, which is nuts for a baseball player. But do you see yourself chasing playing opportunities again, or is coaching where your focus is now?
Yes, I do believe that I will definitely test out some pro opportunities down the road. I know that I will make definitely a final decision once I'm 100% healthy. But in the meantime, definitely just give all I have to coaching and
be where your feet are.
Exactly.
Yeah. And put some action behind it too. For athletes listening, or people listening who might be dealing with setbacks, we all have them. What advice would you give right now for them?
You definitely have to set goals through your recovery, whether it's, you know, be able to bend my knee or a certain amount by this day, or whether it's has nothing to do with baseball. It's, get into the guitar. You know, I'm going to be sitting around doing nothing for the next 2 months. Yeah. Might as well grow in other ways, whether it's reading a book or just always find ways to get better.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk a little bit about the 24 chip theory that I'm working on right now. But yeah, it's like, what are you going to spend your chips on? And it's one of those things where those goals, sometimes when you're going through tough times, they don't have to be these enormous goals. Mm-hmm. It's important to set these little goals. And maybe that goal is learning how to do something, or reading a book, or, you know, listening to a podcast on, you know, the mental side or the physical side, or the, you know, reading a story about somebody else who's went through something. It's not the misery loves company thing. It's just like, I want to understand, like, this can be done, whether it's Roger Bannister's, you know, mile stuff or anything else. Once people know that it's possible, you can do stuff. But when you're going through tough times, it's super important to set some maybe lower goals to accomplish. And that's where confidence gets built. And I think that when you look at your journey as a player through the injury and now as a coach and all the things that have happened to you, it's you can consistently just keep showing up. You keep putting in effort. You keep stacking bricks. You have a smile on your face, and you've made a really large impact in our program, not only as a player, but as a coach. And I really thank you for that. And your story reminds all of us that setbacks don't define you. They redirect you. Ryan was headed to the Division I level, but when injury changed his path, he chose to pour into others and strengthen the program that he'd helped build. That's uncommon. Build the right habits, lead with intent, and push yourself beyond the limits others set for you. And don't forget to cherish the small moments. They pass by in a blink of an eye. Until next time, keep stacking bricks and go Stars.
Coach Cut's Corner is recorded live in the WLMZ studios with Dalian Lowry providing engineering and production assistance. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share it and follow us on all forms of social media. Our program has been built and maintained with the help of many great people. If you want to be part of our mission, you can donate using the link in the show notes below. You can learn more at CoachCutter.com and more about our team at LCCStars.com. See you next time.
Keep connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
LCC Library empowers the Lansing community to learn, teach, and discover. Located on the second and third floors of the Technology and Learning Center at the corner of Capitol and Shiawassee on LCC's downtown campus, the LCC Library's ambient spaces are available to the public for work, study, or quiet personal projects. In addition, those with memberships at collaborating libraries are free to check out materials from the LCC Library's collections. For more information, visit lcc.edu/library.
Hi, I'm Melissa Kaplan, and I host a show called Galaxy Forum on LCC Connect. It's all about the creativity in our classrooms and on campus here at LCC and the connections we have with the community. You can catch Galaxy Forum here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
She's kind of a big deal. Some people like to say it's only because of how she looks. She sticks her tongue out a lot. But there's just something about her that makes people do crazy things. Like get tattoos of her face, or wait in line for hours just to say hi. Lil Bub is a 2-year-old cat, an Instagram celebrity with a following bigger than some 90s television stars. And it all started because she was adopted. You can't buy a best friend like Lil Bub, but you can adopt one. Help us save them all at bestfriends.org.
Lansing Community College's Business and Community Institute provides businesses with customized, synergistic trainings that realize logistical opportunity. Learn more about the future of business today at lcc.edu/BCI.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Welcome to The Safety Plan, the show where I cover the latest cyber scam and how to avoid it on LCC Connect. Voices. Vibes. Vision. I'm Paul Schwartz, and I'm happy that you are here. Let's do this. This morning, my daughter was singing Ordinary People by John Legend, and now that song is stuck in my head. I guarantee you've heard of it. We're just ordinary people. We don't know which way to go. Because we're ordinary people, maybe we should take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, 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 oh. This time we'll take it slow. But my kid was singing with cybersecurity words. Something like this. We're just ordinary people going fast and getting scammed. Because we're ordinary people, maybe we should take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, 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 oh. This time we'll take it slow. Obviously, the college has allowed me budgetless artistic freedom on this show, and I will take advantage of that position. So, welcome to the Safety Plan Show. Here's the format. I will describe a real-world cyber scam like phishing or, you know, IRS imposter scam or scareware or one of the many other cyber scams. I will then explain why it could happen to you and finally how to protect yourself so it doesn't happen to you. So why should you listen to the Safety Plan episode? First, As a leader, I want to share my cybersecurity knowledge with you so that hopefully you can become inspired by it. Second, a community knowledgeable on cyber scams will not fall for them in the future. And finally, if people start practicing good cyber practices in their lives and at home, then they practice those same skills at work, which makes your business or company or local community college more secure. Win, win, win. So I'm Paul Schwartz. I work at LCC as the Director of Information Security, and I coordinate security issues for the college. Things like reviewing emails for legitimacy and implementing projects to improve the college's security and proactive phishing our employees and training them on cybersecurity. I've worked in cybersecurity for 27 years, including 20 years in the Air Force, before ending up at LCC. I have a corner office at work, so people think I know stuff, which proves I am smart. S-M-R-T smart. Now, today's topic is going to be on gas pump skimming, a form of credit debit card compromise. Back in October of 2021, Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development found credit card skimmers at 8 different gas stations in the state of Michigan. 2 were in the Lansing area, one on the west side and one on the east side. Now, gas pump skimmers are small electronic devices, otherwise known as card readers, that can be illegally attached to payment terminals at gas pumps. And they could be inside stores or also at restaurants and so forth. Gas card pumps are targeted because they are unattended. Experienced criminals can install a gas pump skimmer in under 1 minute. They first began to appear around 2015 and have grown exponentially since. Skimmers come in all shapes and sizes and varying degrees of complexity. These card readers grab data off a card or a debit card's magnetic strip without your knowledge, which gives fraudsters full name on the card, the credit card number, and the expiration date. Criminals sell this stolen data or use it to buy things online and create cloned bank cards. You won't know your information has been stolen until you get your statement or an overdraft notice. Once they retrieve your credit card info, these skimmers wait months, sometimes years, before they use the info to purchase items. Now, let me talk about what gas stations are doing to prevent credit card skimming. So first of all, they have gas pump door stickers. Now, these are the little stickers, these little seals they put over the doors. And when you open the door, it breaks the seal. And even some stations now have a warning signal that goes off inside the store when the door to the gas pump is open. Now, their gas stations are also putting up cameras monitoring the gas pumps. They're even doing inspections on the gas pumps, opening them up and looking inside of them. The cashiers at these gas stations, although sometimes minimum wage jobs, are watching and looking for these scammers and watching the gas pumps. And these gas stations are also trying to use better locks on these gas pump doors, and maybe even 2 locks that need 2 people to open the gas pumps. However, it's impossible, even with all these things that gas stations are doing, it's impossible to avoid gas pump skimming. And here's why. Let me tell you what the criminals are doing. So criminals are putting skimmers directly over the gas pump or ATM readers. They could also be putting what they call a card shimming device, which are paper-thin strips hidden inside the card slot. So now instead of putting it on the device, they're actually going inside the device. And these shimming devices can be used to clone the magnetic strip on your card, but only if the bank issuing the chip card hasn't implemented the EMV standard. So they're targeting chip-based credit and debit cards. A shimmer is named as such because it acts like a shim sitting between the reading device and the chip on the card that you insert. Or criminals could be using a combination, say a combination of a card reader and, say, a camera attached to the device or somewhere near the gas pump to record your ATM PIN and passcode. Criminals may also be installing fake keypads on top of the keypad or in replacement of the keypad or a credit reader extension. Skimmers may also be inside the machine. So these may have the universal key or the key to the gas pump door, which if you will look on eBay, you could do a search for universal key for gas pumps. And so they use that to open up the door of the gas pump and put their skimmer inside the pump. As I mentioned before, the gas stations place this tamper-resistant seal on the door, which usually look like a piece of red tape. Criminals might use their own tape, their own tamper-proof tape, to replace the tape once they open those gas pump doors to make it look like it hasn't been tampered with. And after the scam has begun, These will typically return to the scene from time to time in order to retrieve their skimmer, information. However, there are also ways for thieves to use Bluetooth or cellular technology to retrieve this credit card information from the skimming device without even having to be there. Okay, so what should you be doing to prevent this gas pump skimming? Only stop at busy, well-lit, and well-maintained gas stations. Since thieves would rather stay out of sight of the employee inside the store, they will usually install a skimmer farther away from the store and the windows to stay out of sight of the cashier. That means the gas pump closest to the store is more likely to be safer to use. Make sure the gas pump panel is closed, locked, and doesn't show signs of tampering. Many stations now put security seals over the cabinet panels, and if that pump panel is open, the label will read void after they try to reapply it. Look at the card reader itself. Does it look different than any other readers at the station? Look for hidden cameras above it, little tiny pinhole cameras or false shades above the screen of the pump. Try to wiggle the card reader before you put in your card. If it moves, report it to the attendant. Then use a different pump. If the keypad looks thicker than normal, wiggle that too and check it to see if it comes loose. If you use a debit card at the pump, run it as a credit card instead of entering a PIN. That way the PIN is safe and the money isn't deducted immediately from your account. Or you could have a second credit card for the gas purchases, beyond your ATM card. You could pay cash and ask for the receipt, or just pay inside rather than at the pump. How about this? Use mobile payment options like Google Pay or Apple Pay if they're an option. Some newer pumps may also have encrypted credit card readers. Look for an illuminate green lock symbol near the credit card reader to signify this. Now, you should also monitor your credit card and bank accounts regularly to spot unauthorized charges from, say, a skimming scam event. There are also skimmer detectors for smartphones. One I looked up was called the Skimmer Scanner. Now, this app will scan the immediate area for Bluetooth devices that some thieves use to skim your card information. And this is not foolproof because perhaps they'll pick up wireless headphones or other Bluetooth or low energy devices, or maybe the skimming device doesn't have Bluetooth technology. Maybe it uses cellular, or maybe it has direct access. Here's another important thing. Be sure to cover the keypad with your hand to block any potential cameras from seeing your PIN code. Although, I've read some research about an experiment where they had artificial intelligence program look at the camera video, and it could predict your PIN based on the movement of your arm and hand. You're going to have to move your hand pretty wildly as you cover it while you're typing in your PIN. So, after you've become a victim of gas pump skimming, if your credit card has been compromised, report it to your bank or card issuer. Federal law limits your liability if your credit, ATM, or debit card is lost or stolen, but your liability may depend on how quickly you report the loss or theft. Second, if you get a notice of a purchase you didn't make, you can contact your credit card company and stop any other transactions quickly. Work with the fraud department to resolve this issue. Next, notify law enforcement and file a police report if you've been a victim. Next, file a complaint with the MDARD. That's the Michigan Department of Agricultural and Rural Development Weight and Measures. They're the ones that do the inspections and follow up on these scams. Limit your use of a debit card because the money comes out of your account immediately is much harder to get back. And next, you may want to consider putting a freeze on your credit report to ensure no new accounts are opened in your name. And finally, continue to monitor all of your accounts and check your credit report to watch for unusual activity. That's a wrap of today's Safety Plan episode. If you have questions or have been a victim of a cyber scam, tell me about it by emailing lccinfosec@lcc.edu. You can find more information at lcc.edu/connect. This episode of The Safety Plan was recorded by Paul Schwartz in the TLC Tower at downtown Lansing Community College and produced by Lane Ingram and engineered by Big D today. I'm Paul Schwartz, and this is LCC Connect, Voices, Vibes, Vision. So long.
Connecting you with Lansing Community College, this is LCC Connect.
LCC
Connect.
Voices,
Vibes,
Vision.
Studies show that students who take part in sports often see stronger concentration, better problem-solving skills, and higher academic achievement. At Lansing Community College, athletics plays an important role in student success with opportunities to compete in basketball, baseball, track and field, volleyball, and more. LCC athletes learn teamwork, discipline, and leadership, skills that last long after the final game. Find more information on supporting student athletes at lccstars.com.
I'm Stephen Cutter, and I host a show called Coach Cut's Corner here on LCC Connect. Coach Cut's Corner is about Lansing Stars baseball program, mental performance, and just getting better in everyday life. You can always find more about LCC Connect shows and listen on demand at lccconnect.org.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, "Mom, we'll figure it out."
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Lansing Community College welcomes transfer students. Transfer students may apply prior credits toward their LCC degree, certificate, or transfer program. Learn more at lcc.edu/youbelong.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and today's guest was quite literally born and raised into the blues scene. This Dayton, Ohio native was born into blues royalty, raised at the feet of her late father, Tommy Tucker. She started out, as many musicians do, in her home church, but a 1994 performance at the Apollo Theater set her on a path that has continued more than 30 years later. She has shared the stage with the biggest names in the blues, including B.B. King, Coco Taylor, Etta James, and Buddy Guy, just to name a few. Now, I could keep going, but hey, we've got her here, so let's get the stories directly from Teenie Tucker herself, shall we? Teenie, what an honor. Welcome to Time Signatures. How are you?
Good, and thank you for having me.
It is an honor, and I have you know that the post I've been following on your Facebook page have led me to add some key pieces to my blues collection, including your late father's high heel sneakers and a couple of your works as well. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
Well, Teenie, what are your earliest memories of music?
Well, I tell you, my earliest memory, I was probably about 7-8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was never around very much because he was always out touring and playing. And none of my other siblings liked music the way I did. So I remember my mom, I told my mom I wanted a radio. Get me a radio for Christmas. We were allowed to have one thing, big thing, because she couldn't afford to get too much. So I got my radio for Christmas. I turned that radio on and I heard this big voice. Didn't it rain, children? Rain all night long, oh my Lord, didn't it rain? I was like, oh my God. I told my mom, I said, who is that? And she said, that's Mahalia Jackson. And she said, she's a singer. And I said, I want to sing just like her. And so I joined the church choir when I was about 12. And I stayed in that choir till I was like 20 years old. So I did most of my singing in the gospel choir from a very young age. And then I ended up singing blues in probably about my early 20s.
Wow. Did you have any favorite bands or songs that you just had to keep hearing over and over again when you were young?
When I listened to a lot of gospel when I was young, I used to like people like Reverend Cleveland and the Staple Singers and Mahalia Jackson, like I said. So I listened to a lot of gospel, the Hawkins Singers, and because we kind of did a lot of their songs when we were younger in our church choir.
Yes.
And then I did my first recording. My first recording was with the United Gospel Choir in Columbus, Ohio. And there was a lady named Doris Akers, and Doris Akers was a famous hymn writer. And she came from Los Angeles, California, and she auditioned us. We had what you call the convocation choir. That's where all the other choirs in the other areas would come together every year, and we would make a big choir.
Wow.
And so she auditioned about 7 or 8 of us to do some of her hymns. And she had a song called Meet Me in Heaven. And she wanted me to do that song. So that was my first recording on the big album. I guess that's the 78 or the 73.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I did, my first recording was Meet Me in Heaven by Doris Akers. If you look her up, she's since passed away, but you will see she's done a lot of hymn writing. She has a lot of videos out too.
I will definitely do that. Once you started down this path, has it always been the blues for you?
Yes, I'll tell you how it happened.
Okay.
When my father passed away in 1982, I was 21 or 22, something like that. I can't remember. But I had just visited him, and he got really ill after I left. And he got sick on January 10th, went in the hospital in 1982, and he died on my birthday, January 22nd in 1982. Well, there was a guy, he's since passed away as well. He was a promoter and manager over in Germany, Berlin. And he called me one day and said, "Teeny, do you sing blues?" And I was like, "No, not really." I said, "I basically sing just gospel songs, and maybe I'll do a top 40 or a wedding or something like that." And he was like, "Well, if I send you remember the little cassette tapes?"
Oh yeah.
He sent me a little, cause you know, the kids don't have no idea what that is now, but
yeah.
He sent me a little small cassette tape, and he had like maybe 20 songs on there. He only wanted me to learn 5 or 6, maybe 10 songs. And he had people in there like Coco Taylor and Nina Simone, Mavis Staples, Winona Carr. I mean, he has so many people on there for me to learn. Big Mama Thornton, different songs he had on there. Well, when I turned that cassette tape on, my kids were little then, and I would turn that on every day. Etta James, which was one of my favorites. And so I started listening to the music. I said, "Man, I really like this music." And by that time, my dad was gone.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, "Dag, I wish I would have known this, that I love this music when he was still here." And so I learned all 20 of the songs. And my kids would go to school and say, "We heard Etta James today." Or people looking at them like, "Who's that?" you know, like my grandsons and them, my grandson, I would pick him up from daycare. He's like 4 years old. He said, "Nanny, put on John Lee Hooker." You know, people wondering, what does these little kids know about these? Oh,
wow.
You know, so it became a part of me. And then I got real interested in learning about the pioneer classic women of blues. I was like, wow, that the things that they went to and how they were oppressed and how they migrated to the North and became great artists, you know. And I started reading the history and I fell in love with blues. Fell deeply in love with blues, its culture, its history, its music, everything.
You know, you sound like an earlier version of me, because I was late to the game. I was raised with a respect and an enjoyment of the blues by my mom, you know, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, all the regular guys that you would think of, Muddy Waters. But I was much later in life before I got involved in it like I am now. But
right.
As you heard me reference earlier in this episode, you truly were born into blues royalty. Did you have a good relationship with your father when he was around? Did you ever get to see him perform or anything?
Oh, yeah, I did. I tell you, when I was younger, you know, my mom and her friends were in Dayton, and there was an upper valley and the lower valley of Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
And so those women would go sneak up to the upper valley of Dayton just to hear blues. And so my mom and her friends would frequent the club a lot. My dad played there. And so she fell in love with my dad. He fell in love with her, but he had a wife and kids. And so then I come along. But she really didn't want him to know that I was even born.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I guess she saw a friend in the grocery store, and I was in the stroller, and he says, I didn't know you had a baby. And she said, yeah. And so he went back and told my dad, Deanie got a little girl. And he filed me, and that the rest is history. I mean, I was probably about 10 months old. So then every summer when school let out, he'd fly me on TWA to New York and the New Jersey area where he was playing. So I go every summer and spend time with him and the other kids. And out of all the kids that my dad have, I'm the only one that sings and write music.
Wow.
So that's really funny that, you know, nobody else does it but me.
If you know anything about my show at all, I'm always on the hunt for a good story. And you've got quite a few of them to share.
I got quite a few.
Yeah. So I would like you to begin with that 1994 concert at the legendary Apollo Theater, a venue, by the way, well known for its notoriously cruel and scrutinizing audiences. How did that opportunity present itself to you? And was there any part of you that wasn't scared to death knowing the history and reputation of that theater?
Oh, I got a story for you there, buddy.
It's all yours.
One of my best friends from elementary school, and we're still friends, she says, you need to go sing at the Apollo Theater. And I was like, no, I would never go sing at the Apollo Theater. I said, that's the cruelest crowd you ever want to sing before. I said, if you make it through the singing at the Apollo Theater, you can make it through any crowd. So she and I drove all the way to New York in the weather, the stormy, snowy weather. I mean, it was bad. It took us so long to get there. But I had already contacted a lady that schedules you in to come and audition. And when I got there, the line was so long, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'll never make it. We stayed at the hotel on 49th and Broadway. And when you drive down to the Apollo Theater from there, it's like you're never gonna make it. It's only like 3 or 4 blocks away, but the traffic is so bad. So we got there, my nerves was bad. There was this couple that was doing Sam and Dave from out of Kansas City. And they said, well, can we ride down with you guys? I said, no, you're my competition. I can't let you ride with me. Soft on me, you know, I let them ride with me. So we get down there, and this line is like out the door. And there was like maybe like 10 people before me, or maybe more. I just kind of I windled myself up a little bit. You know, I told the lady, I said, ma'am, I talked to you on the phone. I drove all the way from Ohio. I said, can you please let me come in and just do my audition? She said, okay, I'm gonna put you in number 10. I said, oh, thank you. I was so happy. Well, about 3 or 4 of the people that went before me, you got like a minute to show them what you can do. And they were cutting these people off. This lady was doing Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. Another guy did a song from Sam Cooke. And I mean, they was cutting them off like, thank you. You know, I'm like, oh my God, my nerves got so bad. I was like, man, if these people are not making it, I said, how do I expect I'm gonna make it? But I did a Nancy Wilson song called If I Could. And I said, I'm just gonna go in and do my song, and that's gonna be it. I'm not gonna sweat over this. I said, I done drove a long way. My friend is here, she has confidence in me, and at least I gave it a try. Well, they had these guys sitting in the front, cause they have a little audience there, cause they let the audience, like, you know, they judge you to see if you—
chew them up and spit them out, right?
Yeah, they had these men dressed up in women wigs and all kinds of stuff. Oh, you know, goodness. It was like this different set of audience everywhere. So I'm like, oh my God. And so they let me sing my song all the way through that whole 1 minute. And those guys stood up and they clapped and they were clapping. I felt like I was in a dream world. Like, is this really happening? And they were like, oh my God, you were good. Do you have a manager, or are you signed with someone? Or, you know, they were just going on and on and on. And I'm thinking, well, wow, if I can. But here's what happened. The night that I was supposed to perform, guess who I was up against? The Kansas City, Sam and Dave. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta be up against these people. But there were more too. There's probably like 3 or 4 more acts, you know, and they're gonna pick 2 or 3 of us to carry on to go to the next round. So Sam and Dave made it through that round, and I made it. And then there was like another lady, I can't remember who it was, but We all made it. But the night of the rehearsal, they let you rehearse before you do the show. Remember the Sandman that comes with the stick and knock? Okay, he was talking to me in rehearsal. He said, "What song are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to do Stephanie Mills' song called Home, and it's from The Wiz. When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing." That's the one I did, right? So he said, "I tell you what," he said, "when you start," he said, "try to sing it as much like her as you can. And then when you see that they like it, then you start singing and putting your own self into it." And I did exactly what he told me. And I won 3 times straight.
Wow.
Yeah, it was one of the highlights of my whole music career. I mean, and I told someone, I said, if you can sing at the Apollo Theater, you can sing anywhere.
Yeah, that's
because
fact.
They're a very cruel crowd.
And that's a great jump to the next question here, Tini. You've toured the world. You've played some of the biggest blues festivals in the United States, Sweden, France, Switzerland, Belgium, and Italy. Any favorites in that incredible list?
Well, I tell you, I played a lot in Germany, and my first time that I played was in Berlin. But my greatest one was I opened up for B.B. King in Dresden, Germany in 1996. And I think he just found out he was diabetic. And so his manager comes to me and asks me, "Is there any way that you could like sing a couple more songs, because he's trying to get himself together. We have a doctor looking at him and blah, blah, blah." I said, "Yeah, that's fine. I can do that." So I did a couple more songs, and I was over there with a group called the Jiving Jewels. And Norbert Hess put this band together just for me to come over to sing. Remember when I told you I learned the 20 songs off of the cassette tape? And so that was like one of the highlights of my career, is that I got to open for B.B. King. And he gave me the most nicest compliments. Then I opened again for him in 2010 at the Monterey Bay Blues Festival in Monterey, California.
Nice.
And they named me as the Blues Artist of the Year.
Wow.
And so those were two of my highlights. Really good. I mean, I've had some great highlights. Norbert actually introduced me to Linda Hopkins and Maxine Weldon, and those are two great singers that came before me, you know.
Sure.
And so I learned a lot from those ladies after I met them. They were doing the show Black and Blue in France and in Germany, and I got to go backstage and meet them, because Norbert was really good friends with them, and we spent a lot of time together. Linda Hopkins has passed on, though.
Yeah. Now, that covers B.B. King, but how about Coco Taylor and Etta? Any good nuggets from those experiences? And what was it like standing off to the side, watching these amazing artists tend business following you? Was it at any point a pinch-me moment for you?
Well, Coco Taylor, if you look on my Facebook page now, Robert Hughes plays, he's one of my band members. He's a band leader for me. He put one up with Coco. This was at the Island Park in Dayton, Ohio, probably not even too long after she passed away. And she called me up on stage. I just went there to see her because I'm from Dayton. So I ended up going to Dayton to listen to music. And she called me up on stage, and that was another highlight. And I'll tell you what, I've never seen a woman that loved her fans as much as Coco Taylor did. That lady, she was sick that day. She had just had surgery, and she still got up and performed as if nothing happened, because she wanted to please her fans. And when she called me up, I felt so honored that she did that. And I got a lot of good advice from some of these people as well. But let me tell you my Etta James story.
Please.
Chicago, Illinois. I went to go see Etta James, and I said, I'll drive there myself to go see her. The same way I did with Ruth Brown when I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, which that's another story. But anyway, so when I get there, I can't get backstage. So I said, I want to get as far up the front that I can get. So I ended up getting far up to the front. I mean, it's like me looking at her and she looking at me, and we're almost speaking, right?
Wow.
And so she could see the admiration in my eyes that, man, I'm digging you. I love you. I've been doing your music. I'm this and that. Okay. Do you know that woman looked me in my eyes as if to say, you got this. You got this. And thank you for admiring me. We never said a word, not a single word, but it was like we were sitting in each other's face and our eye contact was just benevolent. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm sitting here looking this close to Etta James. But wow. Let me tell you this too. Etta James has a book out called Rage to Survive, and I actually read her book. But my uncle, which is my dad's brother, that's still alive, he's the youngest out of all of them, mm-hmm. He told me that my uncle Leroy was Etta James' probation officer in the 60s.
Wow.
And in the early 1960s, my uncle Leroy was Etta James's probation officer.
How about that?
Yes.
Very cool. Well, Teeny, Bruce Iglauer of Alligator Records called your album, The Two Big M's, your best vocal effort to date following its 2010 release. Now, that's some high praise for any album and for any musician, but how did you feel about hearing that type of feedback from a man of his pedigree?
I felt honored that he said that. You brought it up and I don't even remember that he said that, but I feel honored about that. And the reason why I think that was probably one of my better albums is that my admiration for Big Mama Thornton and Big Maybell, it was so deep of an admiration. And then when she did so many songs that were, you know, Hound Dog, take Hound Dog, for example, she did Hound Dog probably in 1952 or 53 or something like that with Don Robey, Peacock Records. Then Elvis Presley came along and did it and made a hit out of it. And this woman got $500 for it and they sent her on her merry way. And wow. She died penniless. And so I had a huge admiration for her and for someone like Big Maybell, because Big Maybell was actually from Cleveland, Ohio. And these women were, in order to hide their pain from oppression and being poor and all kind of things that they went through, they got hooked on drugs and alcohol and things that you think is, you know, they didn't have therapists back then. You couldn't lay on the couch and they tell you, oh, this is how you get through.
Sure.
And so I kind of admired that, not kind of, I really admired it. And so I said, I want to do a tribute to them. So I wrote a song called The Two Big M's. And Gil Anthony played it the other day because they just did a blues marker in Arlington, Alabama for the life of Big Mama Thornton. Uh-huh. And so I did a song and he told me, Teeny, I just have to tell you, that's the best tribute song I've ever heard. I said, well, thank you.
And how cool.
And I wrote that song out of the deepness of my heart because I really wanted these women to be acknowledged.
Yes.
You know? And then you look at somebody like Big Maybell. Big Maybell did a whole lot of shaking going on way before Jerry Lee Lewis did it. It was a different kind of style, but she did it. She got hardly nothing for it. And Jerry Lee Lewis, which I'm not putting Jerry Lee Lewis down because I think Jerry Lee Lewis was a great artist.
But sure.
It's just the way the women were treated back then. That were classic female blues of the female blues artists.
And isn't it amazing, sad, but amazing, that the blues actually began with female musicians before the guys came along?
Of course it is, yeah. You look at somebody like Mamie Smith. Mamie Smith in 1920, there was a guy named Perry Bradford. And Perry Bradford was your modern day Quincy Jones. Okay, sure. Quincy Jones was a great, huge producer, okay? He produced a lot of artists. He wrote for a lot of artists. He did a lot of musical arrangements for a lot of artists. Well, that's how this guy was, Perry Bradford. He was a black guy, too. And Oki Records, which was a record label, a subsidiary out of Germany, Oki Records had a woman named Sophie Tucker, and Sophie Tucker was a white artist that could sound black. And so he says he got to get this recording done. He's on a timeline, and it was called Crazy Blues. And she wasn't able to do it. It was just by happenstance because she got ill. So he said, hey, I know a lady named Mamie Smith. Why don't we bring her in and let her record this song? If it goes somewhere, fine. If not, at least we have the deadline of doing the demo.
Sure.
And so they brought her in, and she did the recording. It was in August of 1920. And once they recorded that song, because I think they did one song before that and it didn't do very well, A Thing Called Love or something like that. I can't remember the exact name of it, but she did Crazy Blues. And the song says, and it's something that Perry Bradford wrote and arranged. I can't sleep at night. I can't eat a bite. Cause the man I love, he won't treat me right. He makes me feel so blue. I don't know what to do. I mean, okay, can you imagine the modern day now where somebody like Beyonce sings, if you like it, you better put a ring on it. All the girls went crazy for that song, right? Okay, this is what Mamie Smith did. She was the first to record. Because back then they didn't have recordings. They sold sheet music for 10 cents. You know, people use sheet music to play and perform, but nobody was recorded until Alan Lomax came along. But anyway, so when she sang this song, she sold 700,000 copies in 1 month and 1 million copies in less than a year.
Holy cats.
So you see something like that, right?
Yeah. Wow.
So the next people, they said, Key Records, she has a lady out named Mamie Smith. And this was just down south. I'm not talking about Midwest and the East and West Coast. I'm not talking about any of that. So when these women got to hear it, she sold even more. And so I think, man, I got to get that song, you know, like Beyonce, if you like it, then you better put a ring on it. If you like it, you know, and they can repeat that when she's singing. And she also did that song in a movie, one of the movies back in the day. And so they liked it so much. So they said, wow, I got to find me the next female blues artist of the year so that I can make money like Key Records did. So Paramount Records started looking at different women to bring in. And they had Ma Rainey, Betsy Smith. Betsy was signed with Columbia Records, but I think she did a couple of them with Paramount Records as well. So they were starting to look for all these different women to come in and be stars like Mamie Smith and make them, you know, hit them deep in their pocket. You know, when you talk money, you're going to try to find the next queen of the blues as well. Alberta Hunter and all these women come out the woodwork. And so that's how women paid a tribute or have a big contribution to the blues music from the beginning.
Well, Teenie, where can folks go to find out more about you, maybe buy some of your albums, your merch, your art, or even book you for a gig? And please don't forget your social media.
Right. Okay, so I'm on Facebook, Teenie Tucker, Facebook. I'm on Teenie Tucker Art, Facebook. I have a website, www.teenietucker.com.
Okay.
If you look on YouTube, you'll see and hear me. And if you're interested in booking me and my band, you can go to roberthughes@ameritech.net. or teenietucker@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And we will be glad to see what you need.
Well, Teenie Tucker, it has indeed been an honor to have you on the show today. I want to thank you again for your time and much continued success to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to Teenie Tucker, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, my friends.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
This has been LCC Connect Weekly, a presentation of LCC Connect, a podcast network developed by Lansing Community College. Production and sound engineering for LCC Connect Weekly and its podcasts are provided by Dedalian Lowry and Brendan Skipper. Our theme song, Start a New Day, is performed by Samuel Biggs and licensed through DeWolf Music. To hear today's featured podcast on demand, Learn more about the network, become a guest, or explore ways to get involved. Visit us anytime at lccconnect.com.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.